The Cover Story. The Return of Deadwood. HBO's cutting-edge story is revived as a film, showing viewers once again how the Old West truly looked and sounded. By Joe Layden. David Milch had a dream. After scoring successes as a scriptwriter for Hill Street Blues and as a co-creator of NYPD Blue, the Yale University-educated writer-producer wanted to launch an even more ambitious TV series about dedicated law enforcers. The big difference this time, however, would be the beat these new cops would traverse. Specifically, Milch wanted to mount a weekly drama about the urban cohorts, a group of freewheeling guardians who more or less improvised justice while patrolling the main streets of ancient Rome during the time of Nero. As he would tell an interviewer for Salon.com years later, "I wanted to focus on that idea of how order is generated in the absence of law." When he pitched the project to HBO, the decision makers were receptive to the concept, but there was one problem. The premium cable network was already preparing Rome, a period drama set during the time of Julius Caesar. Maybe, just maybe, Milch could shift gears and change the locale for his project. That, believe it or not, is how we got Deadwood, the critically acclaimed series about life, death, and the often contentious process of community building in the titular South Dakota mining town during the 1870s. The show ran on HBO for 3 seasons, earning glowing reviews and attracting an extremely loyal fan base before its unexpected, and for many faithful viewers, infuriating, cancellation in 2006. "I think that ending was very wrenching for a lot of people," says television historian Matt Zoller Seitz, "because it was like a sudden, unexpected death. I think everybody who was a fan of Deadwood knew the basic outline of the history of the actual Deadwood, and they knew from reading interviews with Milch what he wanted to show us and how it was going to be. But then for the show to be canceled before we got to see all of that? Look, I felt traumatized by it as a viewer. I don't think I've ever felt that way about another show." Now there is good news for Seitz and the millions of other Deadwood devotees. After years of false starts and dashed expectations, HBO has resurrected the drama for a Deadwood movie scheduled to air this spring. Plot details remain relatively scarce, but the narrative reportedly takes place 10 years after the final season 3 episode, in the wake of South Dakota's statehood. According to an HBO press release, former rivalries are reignited, alliances are tested, and old wounds are reopened, as all are left to navigate the inevitable changes that modernity and time have wrought. Returning cast members include Ian McShane, Timothy Oliphant, Molly Parker, Paula Malcolmson, John Hawkes, Anna Gunn, Dayton Callie, Brad Dourif, Robin Weigert, William Sanderson, Kim Dickens, and Gerald McCramey, W. Earl Brown, Sean Bridgers, and Keon Young. Of course, not everyone who has a hankering to see a primetime Western is likely to be pleased by the return of Deadwood. As far back as the first season, Milch told CNI in 2010 he met resistance from traditionalists because the down-and-dirty Deadwood wasn't the sort of Western that people remembered from when they were growing up. Ironically, however, throughout its 3-year run on HBO, Deadwood actually could claim at least one strong tie to Western sagas of yesteryear. Veteran producer A.C. Lyles, who helped keep the genre alive with a series of small-budget, old-fashioned odors starring the likes of John Ireland, Howard Keel, and Dana Andrews for Paramount in the 1960s, was corralled by Milch early on to serve as a consulting producer for the series. As critic historian Leonard Matt Moulton wrote for the Indie Wire in 2013, convinced that Lyles was the only man left in town who knew anything about making westerns. He even worked as an associate producer on Rawhide for one season. Milch insisted that A.C. serve as a consultant for his series and sent a car to pick him up every day and take him to the show's permanent location at Melody Ranch. He was in his 80s at the time and reveled in every minute of the experience. "I don't really recall Deadwood, a western," Lyles told CNI in the 2006 interview. "I call it a frontier story because it's a little different from a traditional western. It's more about the building of a town. David Milch created it, and he's a magnificent writer. Some of the dialogue is almost Shakespearean, but it's also true to life because David was a professor of literature at Yale for several years. He knows a lot about storytelling and how to base fiction on facts. I know the language is a little rough," Lyles added, chuckling at his own understatement. "But David did his research, and he knows that's how it was back then." Oh, yes, that language, that dialogue. A lot of it ear-scorchingly obscene, and none of it printable in this magazine. Advance reports indicate that there is more of the same in the Deadwood movie. And again, Milch is not the least bit sorry. "If you look back to westerns in the 30s and 40s, Milch has told CNI, "the language and the conventions had more to do with the motion picture code, production code, than with the way people really spoke at that time in the West. One of the chief stipulations of the production code was that any obscenity in word, thought, or deed was an offense against the laws of God and man and will not be tolerated in our films. And my research into the West, rather than into the conventions of old movies, suggested to me that, given the absence of statutory law, before turning to outright physical violence, people resorted to violence in language, which included profanity. People who grew up in the 20s and 30s and 40s and so forth, they experienced the works of John Ford and other great westerns as a reality. These stories were experienced as a reality. But that does not mean that they correspond to the way life was lived 150 years ago. I certainly don't begrudge anyone their allegiance to those conventions, and I'd be grateful if they didn't begrudge what I feel are deserved allegiances to other storytelling conventions. It's a safe bet that the roughest of the rowdy wordplay will be reserved for Ian McShane as Al Swearengen, the unapologetically autocratic and ferocious foul-mouthed wheeler-dealer who emerged as the dark heart of Deadwood throughout its initial 3-year lifespan. Call it the perfect union of flamboyant actor and larger-than-life character, and you won't be far off the mark. But as Milch admits, it's a match that very nearly didn't happen. "It's actually a testimony to how wrong I can be sometimes," Milch said, "that I very much resisted the idea of casting Ian McShane when it was first presented. I had originally written the role with Ed O'Neill in mind. Ed and I had worked on a cop show called Big Apple. So when HBO was resistant to that idea, feeling that Ed had appeared on too many network television shows, and proposed Ian, my knee-jerk reaction was not friendly to the idea. And of course, the minute he walked in, he just sort of took ownership of the role and my imagination. I wish I could be as happy about every other mistake I've ever made in my life as I am about that one." The Deadwood movie premieres this spring on HBO. Visit HBO.com for more information. Best of the West. Fascinating figures. Meet some of the innovators, influencers, and interesting individuals who make up the many faces of the modern West. Making a home for visitors in the eclectic West. Sheila Youngblood, owner, designer, Rancho Pillow, Austin and Round Top, Texas. Bold colors, bohemian vibes, wide open spaces. European mounts and rocking chairs and turquoise, you name it. the world of Sheila Youngblood rotates around a Western core. The eclectic designer outfitted her own interiors in a spirited gypsy-like style before literally opening one of her homes to the public to enjoy. Located in Round Top, Texas, Rancho Pillow is the name of the once family-only Youngblood compound, which includes an outdoor bathhouse, saltwater wading pool, poetry library, and a host of vibrant lodging quarters. Perfect for accommodating getaways, parties, girls' weekends, and antiquing trips to Marburger Farm and Round Top Antiques Fair. These 20 acres in central Texas showcase a singular style that combines unbridled colors with the unique whimsy of Youngblood's heart. Folk art from Latin American countries, textiles and curiosities from artisans of the world, vintage treasures, and flea market finds from the fields. It's one creative woman's distinctive twist on a style that has informed the current look of Western interiors. Not since the antler chandelier or the leather sofa has the West tendered a more popular design aesthetic, and Youngblood helped to define it. Hanging on and riding rank. Keyshawn, the White Horse, 2018 PBR Rookie of the Year in Dallas. Keyshawn Whitehorse was born into the Navajo Nation, surrounded by tight-knit familial bounds and the rugged beauty of Utah reservation land. By the age of 5, he had fallen in love with bull riding after seeing it on TV. His family didn't have a rodeo background, but Whitehorse's parents supported their son's passion. From makeshift practices on a metal barrel built by his father to reservation rodeos, Whitehorse began to harness his talents. Eventually, the family relocated to Texas, but the young cowboy held fast to his roots. One thing that has stuck out to me is that no matter how far I go in the sport, never forgetting where I come from. That's what gives me the strength to keep going and keep pushing, says Whitehorse, who turns 22 in June. And by all accounts, Whitehorse is on track to go far. Last year, he won the 2018 Rookie of the Year title at the Professional Bull Riders World Finals. The win came down to the last ride between Whitehorse and another rookie. He credits his faith and family, as well as his heritage, for helping him stay level-headed under pressure. Whitehorse was part of the team when PBR featured a solely Native American squad in its Global Cup competition this February, competing, as he always does, wearing traditional beading done by his grandmother. He hopes Native American youth will be inspired by his accomplishments and pride in his heritage. "I don't want them to just see me as a person who rides bulls," he says. "I want them to see me more as a person that's been where they've been and was able to make something of themselves and not forget who they are and about their family and their morals." Saving Animals and Teaching Empathy. Amanda Geis, star of Amanda to the Rescue, Washougal, Washington, and on Animal Planet. Many people see a dog or cat suffering from multiple maladies, sight and hearing impairment, say, or the loss of both hind legs, or paralysis, and they see an animal that is beyond hope for rescue, one that is destined to be put down. Not 36-year-old Amanda Geis, who operates Panda Paws Rescue out of her Washougal, Washington home, and stars in the Animal Planet show Amanda to the Rescue, along with her kids, Jade and Beast, and partner, Gary Walters. In Geis's eyes, every creature is a perfect fit for someone. Seemingly hopeless cases are well worth the effort to save and nurture, and kindness to animals is a lesson in empathy that all of humanity can benefit from. She just has to invest the right medical care. Her first career path took her to med school, and loving kindness and then find the right caretaker or family, which might mean her own family, in the case of the two-legged boxer Duncan Liu Hu. Her upbeat determination, sweet, supportive family, and the wagging tails and tearful smiles when a pet is matched with a suitable family make the show an addictive, heartwarming respite in the mostly shallow and cruel realm of reality TV. As it is with the show's cast-off animals, the folly of judging on looks is clearly illustrated with Geiss herself. People might be inclined to see a tattoo-covered woman sporting a shaved head as someone to fear or avoid. They'd be wrong. Putting the marketing star on America's team, Charlotte Jones Anderson, Executive Vice President and Chief Brand Officer, Dallas Cowboys, Dallas. The hot pants situation had blown up in 1989. A rumor was circulating that the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders' famous super short shorts were being replaced with bike shorts, and the cheerleaders were outraged. Jerry Jones, who had bought the struggling Dallas Cowboys football team recently, called his daughter, Charlotte Jones Anderson, for help. Then, just 23 and working in politics in Washington, D.C., the recent Stanford grad agreed to help her father out. The hot pants stayed, and so did Anderson. Now, nearly three decades later, her official title is Executive Vice President and Chief Brand Officer, which means she's in charge of everything related to the marketing of the Dallas Cowboys brand, from approving all official team apparel to coordinating all community-related events to overseeing the team's philanthropic efforts. She's worked to market to women in particular. They make up nearly half of the Cowboys fan base. At Anderson's direction, there's now a football-centric website designed by women for women called 5 Points Blue, which features a lifestyle component with easy, healthy, game-time recipes, at-a-glance stories on the players and coaches, and plenty of Dallas Cowboys-centric fashion. For Anderson, it's all about America's team and that iconic star. She lives it and breathes it, and wants you to feel and wear the love, too. Lauren and Valentina Aragon, owners and designers, ACONAV, Maricopa, Arizona. Lauren and Valentina Aragon took their graphic design talents from post-college side hustle to 2018 Couture Designer of the Year at Phoenix Fashion Week. Their fashion house, Akanav, brings ancient indigenous arts to the runway. A portmanteau of Acoma for Lauren's home Pueblo and Navajo for Valentina's tribal heritage. Akanav makes everything from couture gowns to ready-to-wear accessories. Working out of the couple's home in Maricopa, Arizona, CEO and designer Lauren, 39, interprets traditional Acoma pottery motifs in looks silks with a leather edge and metal highlights. Acoma is world-renowned for pottery, but I wanted to do something other than clay, he says. I wanted to see my work as wearable art. The designs come to life when worn. It's a family business, with Lauren's mother serving as head seamstress and helping with large collections and production, and Valentina managing marketing and business operations. The designs are aimed at empowering and celebrating the strength of women, and customers tend to be young professionals or entrepreneurial women in leadership roles. The Akanav woman is empowering, responsible, inspiring, and nurturing, Lauren says. Her presence is one of importance. She is also a little mysterious. You know she has a story to tell. Find Akanav's ready-to-wear accessories and jewelry at markets including Santa Fe Indian Market, August 17-18 in Santa Fe, and the American Indian Arts Marketplace, November 9th and 10th, at the Autry Museum of the American West in Los Angeles. Allison Thompson, winemaker and owner of L.A. Lapiani Wines, Santa Barbara, California. Back in the 1880s, Luigi A. Lapiani left his small town in Calabria, a winemaking region in the toe of Italy's boot, and made his way to California. Discovering the climate suitable, he began to make wines, and by 1935, with Prohibition well over, he was ready to start selling his own under the label L.A. Lapiani. The labels never made it to the bottles because he was diagnosed with cancer and died in 1938. Today, Allison Thompson, the 39-year-old great-granddaughter of Luigi Lapiani, he never met, has picked up where he left off and is achieving the recognition he couldn't have dreamed of. Named a winemaker to watch by the San Francisco Chronicle in 2018, she earned a top release from an emerging label from the Wine Advocate for her 2014 Barbera, 92 points, and 93-plus points for her 2013 Sisquoc, Nebbiolo. In college, Thompson spent a semester abroad in Siena, Italy. A healthy obsession with wine led to jobs in tasting rooms and eventually to specializing in viticulture in grad school at UC Davis. Trips to Italian winemaking regions supplemented her coursework. I got to work in the fields in the vineyards, and we picked all day long from 8 in the morning until 8 at night, and then we'd process the fruit at night, she says. One night, it was 1 a.m., and the moon was rising, and it was backlighting the hills in a castle. It was so dreamy. I was so exhausted, but I was so in love with it all. I still am. On one trip, she got to meet renowned winemaker Angelo Gaja in Barola and taste his Nebbiolos. Thompson was well on her way to translating her knowledge and love of Italian wines to her Central California terrier. Today, her boutique wines, sold under the L.A. Lapiani label, are made by hand, like her great-grandfather's were. She also works as a co-winemaker for Alicia Moore, the singer known as Pink, for her label, Two Wolves Wine. Thompson grew up making jam with her grandmother from apricots they'd picked together, just like her Calabrian ancestors, and hearing stories about her winemaking great-grandfather. With winemaking, I love the science of it, the connection between the arts and agriculture. It's a product that depends on all these factors, and it isn't going to be the same every time. It involves flavors and something more than measurements. For Thompson, who now offers 4 different wines, it's not just about all the exciting factors that go into making a good wine. It's about keeping a family tradition alive. Curing What Ails. Stephen McHugh, chef and co-owner of Cured, San Antonio. Stephen McHugh is electric with determined, focused energy. He is always on the go, whether at his stellar 5-year-old restaurant, Cured, or on the food and wine festival circuit, and he couldn't be happier. We're at a place where I feel comfortable traveling, McHugh tells us at the 2018 Chefs for Farmers Festival in Dallas. The team is really dialed in. The chef is smiling, animated, his arms and hands punctuating his speech. But I can't wait to get back to the restaurant, to jump in and break down a pig. There's so much focus on butchering at Cured, a celebrated San Antonio hotspot in the historic Pearl Brewery complex, lauded for its charcuterie, that the butcher team has its own work shift, the overnight shift. The fruits of their labor, aged meats on view resting temptingly in a 9-by-11-foot glass and metal curing case behind the restaurant's hostess station, suggests the dedication and patience that have earned McHugh and his team multiple James Beard Award nominations, the Oscars of the food world. He was in the official running this year for Best Chef Southwest. Cured is not only one of the best restaurants in Texas, but frankly, in the country. Dig into three perennial charcuterie options: the Gossamer Duck Ham, an egg white dollop of preserved Meyer lemon punctuated pork butter, and a small jar of spreadable tart and zesty apple jalapeno pork roulettes to understand the luscious reasons behind all the praise. Currently, McHugh is excited about the 2-year-old ham. "We used to do ham at 12 months. They're ready at 12 months, but they're a wetter ham, most like prosciutto. 2 years ago, during a trip to Spain, I realized everything the Spanish do is on an average 18 months to 24 months and beyond. You're able to hand-carve ham aged for 2 years instead of using a slicer. The result is so much better. I think it's some of the best stuff we've ever done. I'm really proud of it." There's more to McHugh and Cured than cured meats. The restaurant's name is also a reference to McHugh's successful battle against non-Hodgkin lymphoma. This second chance is not lost on the 43-year-old chef. Cured's proceeds help benefit a monthly charity, and McHugh hosts an annual Cured for a Cure benefit dinner, for which all-star chefs like Aaron Franklin of Franklin Barbecue in Austin and Justin Yu of Theodore Rex in Houston pitch in a course. Still, an acute sense of time and patience informs everything McHugh does, from the craft and science of aging meat to the building occupied by Cured. The former administrative offices of the Pearl Brewery are more than a century old. The building shows its age in spots, an exposed beam here, a brick wall there, but that's deliberate. The building's new lease on life mirrors McHugh's own, open, energetic, and full of life. Breata Brannaman, Horsewoman, Sheridan, Wyoming. At a mere 25 years old, Breata Brannaman has a resume that rivals the CVs of cowgirls twice her age. As a sophomore at Montana State University, she was the youngest instructor in the school's history, teaching a class on starting colts in the Department of Animal and Range Sciences. From there, she went on to produce the Brannaman Pro-Am Vaquero Roping. A Yeti brand ambassador, she's a passionate horseman and proven badass, as her online Yeti bio puts it. It's little wonder that Brannaman is an overachiever. She's the daughter of legendary horseman Buck Brannaman, the principal inspiration for Nicholas Sparks' best-selling book, The Horse Whisperer, and Robert Redford's movie of the same name. Her famous father got her started training colts at the age of 12. "My dad is the best there is," Brannaman says. "Once I started to learn, I have never stopped. It is such a great place to start working with horses. You're at the beginning of their education, and every horse presents a new learning experience. Horses are bred to be flight animals, so you should start teaching colts as soon as they're born by laying your hands on them." Despite all she's learned from him, Brannaman's hero is not her father, but his foster mother, Betsy Shirley, who took Buck in and raised him from a young age, saving him from abuse and nurturing him with love. Shirley died 2 years ago, but remains an example to Riata. "Grandma Betsy was a great horsewoman. With her husband, she helped put my dad on the path he chose and always had something positive to say," Brannaman says. "We would call her the Mother Teresa of Montana." Todd and Tonya Forsberg, horse wranglers and livestock providers for film and television, Forsberg Ranch and Company, Fillmore, California. If you've been a lover of modern and historical westerns over the last 15-plus years, It's a good bet you've seen the livestock that Todd and Tonya Forsberg provide for projects on both the big and small screen. Both come from rodeo families, so starting a business that had to do with horses was natural. The two have served as livestock coordinators, stunt performers, and horse wranglers, and provided free-range Liberty dancing horses to sets across the country, including the HBO series Deadwood, the new Deadwood movie, Jane Got a Gun, and Woman Walks Ahead. Although Todd and Tonya have been honing their craft for almost 20 years, their experiences on Woman Walks Ahead, in particular, left indelible impressions. For Tonya, it was the work she did with Jessica Chastain. Jessica was amazing and really good with the horses, not afraid of them at all, and didn't need to keep her distance. For Todd, it was the challenges the film presented. The entire film was shot in New Mexico, and when the unit production manager called me, she said, "You have just 6 weeks to find and train all the horses and get the actors ready to ride." As tough as it was, Woman Walks Ahead was probably one of the most rewarding projects we've ever been involved with. Chloe Zhao, writer, director, Ojai, California. Chloe Zhao began 2018 by winning the inaugural Bonnie Award, a prize for mid-career female filmmakers that comes with a $50,000 grant, at the Independent Spirit Awards, and ended it with the National Society of Film Critics voting her indie drama, The Rider, as the year's best picture. In between those two milestones, Zhao attracted rave reviews and appreciative audiences for The Rider, her stylistically audacious and emotionally wrenching drama-documentary hybrid about Brady Jandreau, played in a bold stroke by casting by Brady Jandreau, a Lakota cowboy and rodeo competitor who's forced to consider the potentially fatal consequences of pursuing his career after a bucking horse stomps on his head during a mishap at the 2016 PRCA rodeo in Fargo, North Dakota. Zhao, a Chinese-born New York, London, and Massachusetts-educated filmmaker who now resides in Ojai, California, met Jandreau while filming Songs My Brothers Taught Me, her acclaimed 2015 debut feature about the relationship between Lakota Sioux siblings on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. She drew heavily on what she learned during that experience and what she discovered about Jandreau's true grit to accurately portray life on and around the reservation in The Rider. "The people there have a very strong connection to the land and the animals," Zhao told CNI last year, "and it's not a cliche, New Age thing. It's very bone deep in these people, so much so that they just can't pick up and leave and work in the city. The young people, I think, struggle a lot with that identity. They're on Facebook, they're on Instagram, but at the same time, when they get out of their house, it's the most beautiful place on earth." Taking advantage of the heat afforded a newly in-demand director, Zhao, who turned 37 in March, has accepted an offer to direct an upcoming Marvel Comics blockbuster, The Eternals, based on the Jack Kirby-created superhero team franchise. But CNI readers may be more interested in her next film, Nomad Land, a contemporary drama starring Frances McDormand, Fargo, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, as Fern, a woman in her 60s who, after losing everything in the Great Recession, embarks on a journey through the American West, living as a van-dwelling, modern-day nomad. Based on the nonfiction book Nomad Land, Surviving America in the 21st Century, by Jessica Bruder, Zhao's latest effort as a writer-director is not yet scheduled for release by Fox Searchlight Pictures. "As I fell in love with the American West," Zhao said in a Fox Searchlight press release, it was impossible not to become fascinated with the roads that lead to the many adventures beyond the horizon. I'm very fortunate to be able to hit the road with a talented team and collaborate with a cast of professional and non-professional actors who are deeply giving and inspiring. I can't wait to share their stories and what we've discovered along the way. Zhao hopes to return again to the West sometime soon for another project on her agenda, an Amazon Studios-produced biographical drama about the legendary Bass Reeves, the first black U.S. deputy marshal to hunt outlaws west of the Mississippi River. I'm looking for a way to tell the story that spans 50 years of this extraordinary man's life, she told CNI, from escaping slavery during the pre-Civil War period to living in the Indian Territory and then becoming a deputy marshal there. I want to look at history from a different perspective and explore how the Old West is a place where people from very different backgrounds came together and formed relationships. Even though they had issues and conflicts, they still built the Old West together. Designing for Rural Communities, Thomas Hurlburt, Architect, Co-Founder, Co-op Architecture, Aberdeen, Rapid City, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota. The head dog at Co-op Architecture is not co-founder and principal Thomas Hurlburt. Upstaging the 2018 AIA Young Architect Award winner and calling the shots is Wild Bill Hickok, Hurlburt's long-haired wiener dog. In his younger days, he was a grand champion at the local German Fest wiener dog races, Hurlburt says. He's parlayed that victory into becoming our office PR man, but he's been underperforming as an employee for a while. He generally lies around, but he barks every day at the FedEx guy. Not sure why. The FedEx guy is a great guy. Don't let Hurlburt's sense of fun fool you. He's serious about reviving rural America with good design and doing it in a spirit of cooperation. While his passions run to his family, Wild Bill, wife, and young son Landy, old trucks, the 1969 F-250 he just sold, Dwight Yoakam, my king, and his radio show, Rock Garden Tour, a weird South Dakota version of A Prairie Home Companion. He's also dedicated to doing his part to make sure rural America has good architecture. We've undervalued design at times around here, and we want to help bring that value back, he says. We think there are cultural benefits, sure, but also economic benefits. Better design influences the quality of our lives, in enjoyment, but even more so in performance. We believe in the values of collaboration and cooperation between friends, neighbors, farmers, and cities. We love the rural lifestyle and landscape, and we want to emulate that feeling with our clients and our consultants. Two examples. The K.O. Lee Aberdeen Public Library, which has become the town's living room, and the historic Minneapolis and St. Louis Railroad Depot, which Hurlburt bought, renovated, and saved from the wrecking ball. He co-founded the Downtown Aberdeen Revitalization Team, a.k.a. DART, with other community-minded folks. We were tired of empty and dilapidated downtown buildings, so we formed an LLC, recruited 19 members, and raised a little cash. So far, we've purchased 3 buildings and flipped them. It's definitely not a moneymaker, but it might help save downtown and improve property values. That's the spirit of co-op. But that's Hurlburt wearing his professional hat. Here's the aspiring cowboy wearing his cowboy hat. I was talked out of naming our firm the James River Gang, after a nearby river, because our first clients were some nuns, and there was concern that we might come off as a bunch of misfit outlaw bandits, which we are. Find out more about Thomas Hurlburt's firm at coopArch.com. Anita Lucchese, founder of Sovereign Bodies Institute, Northern California. 4 years ago, Anita Lucchesi, still healing from a shattered hand from an encounter with her abuser, began to build a database, a comprehensive list of women who had gone missing from their communities or were murdered, noting which were victims of sexual or domestic violence or human trafficking. I wanted to find a good working number of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the U.S. and Canada, and everyone from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to Amnesty International had a figure, but they were all different, says the 27-year-old who comes from the Cheyenne people. Frustrated with the absence of clear answers, she filed Freedom of Information Act requests with law enforcement, dug into newspaper archives, reached out to families, and used social media. Today, she has logged more than 3,500 cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States and Canada, and she believes there are 20,000 to 30,000 more, making her database one of the most comprehensive in North America. Lucchesi's initial goal was to make the information available to tribal communities so they could create effective policy to prevent future violence, but it's already grown beyond that. Earlier this year, she launched a nonprofit Sovereign Bodies Institute, an affiliate of Seventh Generation Fund for Indigenous Peoples, which will continue to fill out the database and do research. We can't work to make sure women and girls are safe if we don't fully understand the causes and roots of violence, Lucchesi says. The more data we collect, the more we can understand what will be effective in addressing and preventing this for the next generations. Shooting straight. Brady Ellison, Olympic archer, Globe, Arizona. World champion archer Brady Ellison has been on our watch list since the 2016 Summer Olympics. His passing resemblance to Leonardo DiCaprio may have drawn attention, but it was his recurve bow skills and belt buckle that got ours. A four-time winner of the Hyundai Archery World Cup, Ellison nabbed an individual bronze and a team silver at the 2016 Rio Games and a team silver in 2012 in London. Born in Miami, Arizona, Ellison spends what little free time he has hunting, fishing, and attending rodeos and NFR's Cowboy Christmas. If his hobbies aren't proof enough, the 30-year-old wears his cowboy country pride on the outside. He can always be seen in competitions hiding his shaggy blonde locks under a fishhook-embellished baseball cap, or, in some interviews, a cowboy hat. But his most indispensable archery accessory is his enormous signature belt buckle that reads, "Remembering Lane Frost." The archer claims the late world champion bull rider, who died at 25 during 1989 competition in Cheyenne, Wyoming, as his idol. The buckle is his lucky charm, and he never competes without it. We'll be looking for it as Ellison trains for the 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo. Making the costumes that make the characters. Jenny Egan, costume designer, Los Angeles. As a Los Angeles Times story headline declared, clothes may make the person, but costumes make the character. Just ask any actor. Ask any actor who has worked with costume designer Gina Egan, and you'll find proof of the point. It's been a bit more than a decade since Egan was the assistant costume designer on No Country for Old Men. She next made her mark with the costumes she assisted with for the 2010 remake of True Grit. The following year, she worked on Cowboys and Aliens. Her recent credits, nominations, and awards include the films Widows and Beasts of No Nation, and the series Maniac, True Detective, and Olive Kitteridge. But her breakthrough Western came in 2017 when she was the costume designer on Hostiles, creating the look and mood for Christian Bale, Rosamund Pike, Wes Studi, and the rest of the cast portraying the hazardous frontier during the early 1890s. Set in 1892, Hostiles required a fair bit of research, imagination, and collaboration to recreate the time period and to accurately portray the characters' difficult trek across the West from New Mexico to Montana through threat-filled, hostile territory. There is a history on the Civil War and the Spanish-American War, Egan explains, but not so much on the early 1890s. The time period of the film fell between the wars. I was visiting a whole new world, and it was exciting to decide what worked and what didn't. To accomplish that, Egan welcomed input from the actors on their costumes. Allowing that freedom makes it possible for the actors to dig deeper into their characters, Egan says. During our initial meeting, I was very nervous, but as the shoot progressed, Christian was very specific about how he wanted his cavalry uniform to look, from the tying of his scarf to the position of his belt. Ryan McMahon, comedian, producer of Thunder Bay Podcast, Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. 9 Dead Bodies, Abuse of Power, Scandals at City Hall, Botched Police Investigations. Thunder Bay, the recently released podcast published by the website Canada Land and produced by Ryan McMahon, an Anishinaabe from Cochin First Nation, checks all of the boxes of a terrific thriller. It sounds like an episode of The Wire and a new smash hit investigative series on Netflix, and that's exactly what it is, says McMahon, who lobbied hard to create the podcast. He wanted to find out what had happened over roughly the last 2 decades in Thunder Bay, Ontario, and why the murders of 9 Native teenagers, Ojibwe, Cree, and Oji-Cree, were never solved. I lobbied because of the murders, the ongoing news in the city, and the impacts of ongoing failed policy affecting indigenous peoples, 42-year-old McMahon says. It took a year and a team of 4 investigative journalists to unravel the mystery surrounding the killings, but in the end, he was able to tell the story of these forgotten people. This is a call to arms for non-Indigenous people to go. We need to wake up. We need to be aware of what's happening in Indian country, he says from his home in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Because it's not the first and won't be the last story illustrating the untold crimes against indigenous peoples in North America. Through his own company, the McCoons Media Group, McMahon has launched the world's only member-supported indigenous podcast network, Indian and Cowboy. Known in some circles for his comedy, McMahon is drawn to telling stories, funny or not. I like to use the story. Story is the most human thing in the world, he says. Indigenous stories are a doorway that allows people to walk through and consider our stories and our lives. Setting big trends in a small town. Tiffany Johnson, owner of The Sparkling Spur, Mandaree, North Dakota. Tiffany Johnson, Lower Brulee Sioux, Mandan, Hidatsa, stands out as a queenpin of Western fashion for several reasons, not least her keen sense of personal style. As founder and owner of the Sparkling Spur Boutique, which she established in 2008 in Mandaree, North Dakota, on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, Johnson has been able to accomplish something many others have tried and failed to do. Build a business with a national audience from a remote, rural destination. From a hometown with a population of approximately 600, she's made national waves with her unconventional style and fearless sensibility. She's a trendsetter, not a follower, with a love for Western, Native American, and premier designer fashions, which she weaves seamlessly together into her own wardrobe as well as her store. Edgy, above trendy, blow you away fabulous, one of the customers writes in a Facebook review. But it's not just Johnson's one-of-a-kind style and inventory that draw people in and keep them coming back. She builds relationships with her sparkling spur shoppers. My customers know that I want them to look their absolute best, Johnson says. I want them to feel fabulous. Elizabeth Broombaugh Quirk, Vice President of Broombaugh's Fine Home Furnishings, 2018 Non-Pro World Cutting Horse Champion, 2018 Number 1 Non-Pro Equistat Rider of the Year, Fort Worth, Texas. Her father opened the family's furnishing store in 1966, and Broombaugh's Fine Home Furnishings has been an outpost of decor and design in Fort Worth for more than 50 years. First daughter, Elizabeth Broombaugh Quirk, believes there's nothing typical about it, which is why the business continues to succeed amid a constantly changing retail landscape. A stylish balance between traditional and contemporary is exemplified by the Elizabeth collection she introduced there in 2014. Although Broombaugh's offers Western aficionados a reliable, steady stock of stylish furnishings and home accents, it's pieces like her teal Tibetan occasional chair that pepper the classics with trendy twists and downright swank. Perhaps 30-year-old Broombaugh Quirk benefits from having one foot in the millennial generation. In college, just when social media was emerging, she helped with the company's online presence, and the other in the stirrups. She's a decorated horsewoman who has been riding in national cutting horse competitions for more than 15 years. The result? A perfect blend of the Old West with the new that fits right inside our homes. Telling Stories with No Reservation. Tommy Orange, author of They're There, Angels Camp, California. Blurbs on the book jacket can be deceiving. In the small world of serious literature, praise could come from a buddy of the author, from another writer who owes a mutual literary agent a quid pro quo for wrangling a previous kind of word, or from a hack who just wants to see his name on the cover of a book. At some point, though, the intensity of the acclaim, the sheer number of people raving about the book, and the profile of its admirers amount to a critical consensus. This is the case with They're There, Knopf, 2018. The astonishing literary debut, Margaret Atwood via Twitter, from a 37-year-old Tommy Orange, Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. Told from the various points of view of 12 urban native narrators on their way to a powwow in Oakland, California, and to an ill-conceived but deadly heist, the book was declared masterful, white-hot, Ron Charles, The Washington Post, and the big, booming, explosive sound of 21st-century literature finally announcing itself, Marlon James. It would be quicker to name best of 2018 book lists that did not include it than those that did. When CNI spoke to Orange for the February-March 2019 issue, he was working on two follow-up books, an autobiographical nonfiction one about his family, and another that he was keeping close to the vest, except to say it would be fiction. We can't wait to see what's next from this new talent, who no less than star author Louise Erdrich described as a brilliant and generous artist who has always enlarged the landscape of American fiction. Putting the West's best looks forward. Megan Holern, fashion designer, founder, Livewire Style, Greeley, Colorado. A designer, business owner, and style icon of the contemporary West, 34-year-old Megan Holern is a woman who knows the meaning of hard work. She also knows Western fashion. She's dressed rodeo queens, styled runway shows, and worked with a handful of notable name brands, such as Greeley Hat Works, for which she revamped and relaunched the now widely successful 970 line in partnership with owner Trent Johnson in 2017. In 2013, following her passion for creating pieces from conception to completion, Holdren introduced her own label, Live Wire Style, a Western couture collection that, thanks to the immediate acclaim, she's since grown to include personal styling and Rent the Look services. And after closing her first shop while pregnant with her third child, she's now on the lookout for an ideal space to open a new brick-and-mortar boutique in her hometown of Greeley, Colorado. Last year, she teamed up with former PBR champion Cody Lustro to purchase and rebrand a modeling agency that caters to and represents the Western lifestyle. As part of their business, CM Modeling, the pair offer career and life coaching in everything from portfolio development to how to do your taxes. But that's not to say Holdren has put designing on hold. Her latest venture, a bridal collection of rustic yet modern, elegant yet edgy gowns, befitting a swanky ceremony out west. Promoting pre-contact foodways. Hellel Echo Hawk, chef, pioneer in indigenous food sovereignty. Seattle. Hellel Echo Hawk, Pawnee and Athabascan, knew she wanted to go into cooking when she was 14 years old. But it wasn't until after she had left her hometown of Delta Junction, Alaska, moved to Seattle, and then traveled to New Zealand and returned to Seattle, at the urging of her brother-in-law, that she enrolled in culinary school. It's from Seattle that she works as a private chef and caterer through her company, Birch Basket, which focuses on pre-European contact indigenous foods. That means she and other chefs who practice the same cooking do not use ingredients imported to the Americas by Europeans. Milk, pork, and chicken? No. Corn, beans, bison, squash, and certain berries? Yes. Of course, the yes ingredients vary by and depend on the region and season. The Lakota don't cook and eat the same way as the Navajo. In the case of Echo Hawk, her life in the Pacific Northwest means including seafood and elements like nettles and cedar. She's worked with the Urban Indian Health Institute, the research arm of a health clinic in Seattle overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. 2 years ago, she created a packet of dry soup ingredients that the organization passes out at conferences and other events. I'm super proud of that one, the chef says. Asked how it feels to find a space in the cooking that gives her the opportunity to explore her native foods and share them with others, Echo Hawk responds, "It feels natural and lovely. It's one of the ways, one of my ways, of showing love." Echo Hawk also extends that love and work as a member of the I Collective, a pioneering organization dedicated to indigenous food sovereignty and foodways. The group, which includes chefs like Twyla Cassador, Apache, and Quentin Globus, Frog Lake Creek First Nations, works locally as well as nationally through fundraisers, pop-ups, and community center events. Through iCollective, Echo Hawk has shared her commitment to indigenous foodways in Oklahoma, Washington, D.C., and New York, among other locales. "It makes me so happy when I'm around indigenous people who are doing this work," Echo Hawk says. "When you look at colonization and you look at the genocide of indigenous people and what colonizers do throughout history, you look at any kind of civilization, one of the first three things that they do is they take away the food. For us to still have these foodways is so amazing. Whenever I go to these things, whenever I talk to anybody, an older or an ethnobotanist or another chef or anyone, I'm always learning something. I love to learn about our foodways. It just gets me so excited. Eduardo Jordan, chef restaurateur of June Baby, Solare, Lucinda Grain Bar, Seattle. When Seattle chef Eduardo Jordan smiles, people take notice. It's a smile that feels contagious, coming from the kitchen at June Baby or the stage at the James Beard Foundation Awards, where the Southern Eatery won for Best New Restaurant in the country and he won for Best Chef in the Northwest. And it owns the room at Solare, his first venture, a neighborhood restaurant serving locally sourced Italian dishes. June Baby shot the 38-year-old Jordan to national acclaim with a rave review in the New York Times, along with best restaurant mentions from Bon Appetit and Esquire. The restaurant's slogan, Food with Roots, captures what he is doing so effectively, telling his life story through food. It's at June Baby that he shows off the Southern fare of his upbringing in St. Petersburg, Florida. It's not a gentrified Southern restaurant, he says, of the menu that includes his mama's oxtails and introduces a new audience to pickled trotters. He's won folks over slowly with dishes like crispy fried pig ears and smoked carrots in tahini, enough people that he even tried to expand the restaurant. Foiled by permitting, he instead opened a third restaurant on the same strip, Lucinda Grain Bar. His pastry team is crucial in the new spot. Whole grains have a starring role. Einkorn shows up in ice cream. There's barley in the old-fashioned, and the bucatini, served with pork chili ragu, is made of buckwheat. There's more than just cooking when it comes to being a chef, he says. There's teaching, continuing to learn, and there's a story to be told. Tara Radosovich, wildlife, western, equine artist, St. Petersburg, Florida. She made Southwest Arts 21 Under 31, Young Artist to Watch in 2018, and we can see why. Despite being a lifelong Floridian, 28-year-old Tara Radosovich's passions are horses, animals, and the American West, all of which she lovingly captures mainly in acrylics and graphite pencil. No matter the medium, chasing images in the field with her camera and sketchbook has blessed her with memorable experiences of watching wild animals while my soul bonds to the land itself. When she's not sketching or painting in her Florida studio, Radosovich can often be found outdoors, otherwise engaged in everything from horseback riding and hiking to attending rodeos and wildlife and bird watching. One of my dreams is to visit every or as many national parks as I can. I've only been to a few and only got to stay within a day, she says. I want to return to Yellowstone and get to see wolves up close, a bull elk, moose, and more wild bison. I'd like to return to the Grand Canyon for a much longer trip and maybe even camp there. Her creative influences run from iconic greats like O'Keeffe, Remington, and Russell to contemporary artists including Bonnie Maris, Robert Bateman, John and Susie Siri Lester, and Bev Doolittle. For musical inspiration while she's working in the studio, favorites include Chris Ledoux, Buddy Redbow, and Marty Robbins. Her greatest inspiration is her faith. God blessed me with the gift to create art and the passion for nature in the West. When I create pieces, it's my way of giving glory and praise. Gallery representation in the West seems like it's just a matter of time and exposure. In the meantime, Radosovich's custom pet portraits and commissions for animal, equine, or Western-themed work are within reach.